This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Small Change by Roan Parrish. Narrated by Joe Raylan. Chapter 1. They fell in love with me in a matter of hours as I drove into them, deeper and more permanent than any lover. Some of them relaxed into it, others fought the whole way down. Some drifted gently on it, and others drowned quickly. However they took it, they carried a piece of me with them forever, and I rarely saw them again. My needles slid across skin, leaving a line as pure and smooth as when I used a paintbrush. Jack was heavily tattooed, a lot of it by me, and he knew how to give himself over to the needle, muscle and tendon relaxing beneath the skin, so there was no tension, just a lightly freckled canvas and the blue lines of my stencil to guide my hand. Trained as a doctor and now a curator at the Mutter Museum, Jack was having me slowly cover his remaining skin with tattoos of the skeletal structure. It was my favorite kind of work. Realistic black and gray. So detailed that I could fall into a kind of trance. A meditation of breath and blood and flesh. Lose myself inside the twists and curls of a line and resurface inches of skin in hours later. Jack and I had shared a peaceful coexistence, my hand and my needle the only points of connection between us. As excited as I was about this tattoo, though, I was glad to be nearly done with it. The long day revealed itself in the twinge of my right calf muscle from working the pedal, and the tightness in my low back and shoulders from leaning over. My hand was cramping, and my eyes were crossing from so many hours of close-up work. The shop clock was blurry until my eyes slowly switched to long distance. I'd been tattooing for almost 10 hours, with only brief breaks to eat, switch clients, and run to the bathroom, so it was no wonder I was feeling it. It had become my habit more and more often in the months since Daniel left. Daniel was the best friend I'd ever had. Almost a brother. We reminded each other to do things like eat and sleep. And set our bills to autopay so our electricity didn't get turned off. Hey, that one was totally him. I still couldn't quite believe he was gone. I was happy for him, I really was. He'd gotten a great job in Michigan after years of working incredibly hard in grad school. But god damn, it sucked to be without him. Ever since he'd left, I'd felt at sea. Always about to reach for something I kept forgetting wasn't there anymore. Damn, man, Jack said as we looked in the mirror at the shoulder joint I'd just inked. Standing, he towered over me, and I looked quickly away from my reflection. My dark curls were wild around my pale face, the shadows under my eyes an unwelcome reminder that my schedule lately had been extreme. Jack's long fingers traced the air, hovering over his clavicle, acromion, humerus. You're making the rest of my ink look bad, Ginger. The rest of your ink is bad, I said and winked at him in the mirror. Once I'd cleaned him up and wrapped his fresh tattoo, he handed me a roll of bills. Month after next, probably, okay? Or maybe three. Absolutely. Just shoot me a text and I'll get Lindsay to put it in the book. Scapula next? It would connect the shoulder piece I'd just done to the vertebrae I'd first inked along his spine. Yeah. Yeah. He nodded, eyes dreamy, like he was already envisioning it. Scapula. I locked the door behind him and collapsed in my own tattoo chair, massaging the shaved half of my head over the spot where my migraines usually started, and forcing my eyes to focus on the details at mid-distance so my vision could recalibrate. The black vinyl couches near the door, where people sat and browsed our portfolios, had been cracked from years of use before I ever started working here. But the black and white subway tile looked clean and sharp. Marcus Dade Station was closest to the door, and above it was the poster of a dragon. It was a cheapo poster store fantasy print, like you might see in a dorm room. Marcus had razored out the bottom half and replaced it with a map of Philadelphia, so it looked like the dragon's claws were poised to take out the City Hall clock tower, Center City sprawling beneath its outstretched wings, about to be immolated from the fire it was breathing. Marcus had painted the details slightly overlapping, so it looked like one piece, and he'd framed it in a large, gaudy gold frame he'd found at the thrift store down the street. Morgan Jack's, or Piercer, had the station across from mine, and it was framed by a semicircle of the phases of the moon. Crescent at the bottom left, waxing to full at the apex, and waning to crescent at the bottom right. They were each slightly tinted in pinks, purples, and teals, so the effect was early 90s woo chic, which was pretty apt. Then in the center of the wall, beneath the full moon, was a black velvet painting of a howling wolf in a glittery frame with a word bubble coming out of its gaping maw that said no. The wall behind my own station had a kind of creeping collage that I added to whenever I found something that caught my eye. It began with a glittery ruby slipper that I found on the front stoop of the shop one night and had grown from there. My own magic garden, a smaller version of the mosaic and glass maze of South Street. I must have dozed off for a minute because I woke to the sounds of Morgan and Marcus coming through from the back room. I rubbed my eyes and stars burst behind my eyelids. Shit, you guys are still here? Their eyes darted to each other. Classic guilt. What? What did you do? Oh, jeez, Morgan. You didn't try and cook again, did you? I sniffed the air suspiciously. Morgan was convinced she was a great cook, and sometimes, instead of bringing leftovers for lunch or dinner or ordering takeout like a normal person, she'd plug in a hot plate she'd found in the back storage room and concoct noxious stir-fries. The hot plate must have been there since before Raoul, the previous owner, opened up shop, and I was borderline convinced that someday she was going to burn down the whole building. But mostly I was just glad she kept the windows open while she cooked. Morgan's eyes flashed. You should be so lucky that I cooked for you, Miss Ice Cream for breakfast and on a first-name basis with every delivery person in the neighborhood. At least they don't poison me, I muttered, plucking at the threads in the shredded knee of my jeans. What was that? Morgan cupped her hand with its bright blue nails around her ear, leaning toward me. I said. I appreciate the unique combination of qualities that make you my beloved friend and co-worker. Yeah, that's what I thought I heard. We flashed grins at each other, and then I started the automatic movements of cleaning my station, dumping the used needle sharps, gloves, globs of Vaseline, and wads of paper towel bloomed with ink and blood in the waste bin, disinfecting the chair, my stool, and the floor around us, and replacing my inks. I packed my tattoo machine away in its box. Jonathan, my mentor, had given it to me when I started working here, though over the years I'd made my own adjustments. Etched above the grip in Gothic font, it read Tattoo Bitch, the nickname that had started as a joke between Jonathan and me, but had stuck. Morgan and Marcus were still standing there when I looked up. Christ, out with it, I said when they exchanged another guilty look. I picked at my chipped black nail polish as they squirmed.
Look, Ginger, you know we're both thrilled at all the extra work recently.
Not long after Daniel left town, G. Philly, the queer section of Philly Mag, had done a feature on the shop, naming Small Change the most queer-friendly shop in Philly, in addition to being the only one that was female-owned. It had driven a wave of new clients our way. The added business was much needed, since money had been a real problem for the past year. Now there was more money coming in, but we were all exhausting ourselves trying to cover the business.
But, babe, we were short-staffed before.
Now, Marcus trailed off, opening his arms to the shop around us, which was still trashed. We hadn't had time to tidy things up between clients the way we usually would.
Lindsay says we're booked solid. We've got waiting list clients. It's too much.
His voice was gentle, like always. But he was right. I'd been reveling in the distraction that so much work brought, but my friends were just as swamped as I was. And unlike me, they weren't trying to distract themselves from the fact that their best friend in the whole world had left town, taking with him a piece of what made Philly feel like home. His absence a constant reminder of how good it had felt to have a partner in crime. And how lonely it felt not to have that anymore. You're right. I know. I need to get on hiring someone. It's hard right now because I've been spending every minute I'm not here working on my stuff for Malik's show, but I'll pull some portfolios, okay? I've got a bunch in my inbox. Look, Boo, Morgan said. Thing is, Paul called today. He's floating right now and thought maybe he could set up here for a bit. Paul, I said flatly, my fingers plucking at the tangle of silver chains at my neck. His color work is gray, he tattoos fast, and he likes to do all that gonzo new school shit that you and Marcus both hate. Marcus raised an eyebrow and nodded at the truth of that. Paul, I repeated. Paul, my douchebag ex who roams the planet today only because I am merciful and disinclined toward prison, Paul? Marcus bit his lip, but Morgan soldiered on. If we could just get him in until you found someone permanent, a month or two maybe? I know he isn't the best, but that was an understatement of epic proportion. I'd started sleeping with Paul after an exchange, if not uncharming banter, at a prom-themed birthday party for a mutual friend. Roles were played, prom queens and kings were agreed upon, carry jokes were made, fictional virginities were lost, rollicking good times were had by all. It became a semi-regular thing and turned into us casually dating, and I thought things were going pretty well. After about a month, though, Paul vanished as suddenly and unsatisfyingly as those fabled prom night virginities. After 2 weeks, when I finally sent him a text to see what was up, he began a precision campaign of gaslighting, dismantling our relationship by claiming we were never really together, that he'd found me needy, and that he'd never really been into the sex we'd been having. I knew he was bullshitting me. He'd been the one to bring up dating in the first place. He'd contacted me far more than I'd contacted him, and the sex, well, he'd seemed pretty into it. Regardless, it had made me feel pathetic. Angry and sad, and when I learned he'd shared his complaints with a number of our mutual friends, humiliated. Humiliated not just because of the fallout, but at the memory of how I'd actually thought, even if just for a moment, that we could have something real. I felt like a fool. Isn't the best, I echoed. Dude, he's the fucking worst. Okay, yes, he's a great tattooer. Yes, he's fast. Yes to all of it. But he is a slime human being, and I will not have him working here. The end. Ginge, nope. End of intervention. I don't pull rank often, but this is my damn shop. It's my home, and you guys are like my family. Am I much less fucked up than my actual family? And I'm not poisoning my favorite plays with someone who makes me feel like shit. I won't do it. I'm sorry. Even if I have to tattoo some new school abominations on kids with more stiff-brimmed snapbacks and brains. I told you, Marcus muttered under his breath. Morgan sighed and perched on the counter. Okay, she said finally. You're right. Sorry. Morgan was aggressive and blunt and sometimes offensive as hell. But goddamn, I loved that girl. The second she knew she was wrong, she apologized. No bravado and no bullshit. Hiring her had been one of the best decisions I'd made. She hadn't had much by way of a portfolio since she'd been piercing out of her house for 5 years while working full-time as a manicurist, but her work references were glowing, and when she called five of her friends who lived nearby and asked them to come down so I could look at their piercings, I was amused enough to wait and see. The piercings themselves have been impeccable, but I'd responded to Morgan's way with clients even more. And I'd hired her on a trial basis that we both knew would become permanent. Of course, Morgan's assurances were because of some planet squaring some other planet and the conjunction of a moon in a certain house, but whatever works, right? Morgan and I had recognized each other right away. You could just tell when you met another person whose thick skin had been forged in the fire of difference. I'd been teased and dismissed for not being pretty, for not dressing like I wanted people to think I was pretty, for being outspoken, for not taking shit. In other words, called a bitch or a dyke or a freak at school, and instead of changing, squared my shoulders and rejected their premises. Morgan grew up beautiful, black, and female in a neighborhood that valued her beauty more than anything else about her. She'd been called a bitch, too, for not agreeing, and for not capitulating to the certain kind of power her beauty could have gotten her. Her success, first with manicuring and then with piercing, had spelled independence for her, and we'd bonded over how fiercely we both needed it.
"Sorry, Ginge," Marcus echoed.
Marcus was as considerate as Morgan was blunt, and now he looked even guiltier. He was turning his phone over and over in his pocket, which he always did when he was late calling home. Marcus and his partner Celine lived outside town in a beautiful converted barn that Celine had inherited. They'd been talking about fostering kids, maybe even setting up the barn as a space for queer kids who weren't safe in the system. Marcus thought maybe as a trans man, he could be a resource for some of the kids for whom the threat and impermanence of the system didn't provide the time or privacy to process their identities. But now Marcus had been working way more than usual, and I hadn't heard him mention it in weeks. In fact, had I talked to either of them about anything non-work related in the last week? Or had I been too exhausted to ask, too eager to be absorbed by tattooing so I could forget my own problems? "No," I said, "I am sorry. I've been a speed demon lately, and I didn't think about the pressure it was putting on you guys. I am seriously going to get on it. I have 4 or 5 people who've emailed me over the last 6 months asking about spots. I'll look at them this week. I promise." Their relief was clear, and they both hugged me on their way out. Though my apartment was right upstairs, I sank back down in my tattoo chair and looked around at the shop. At 34, I'd been tattooing longer than not. At this shop, longer than I'd lived in my parents' house. I'd grown up here, watched dozens of other artists come and go, watched businesses move into the neighborhood, thrive and die, watched South Street change and stay the same. It had been the one constant in my life. I'd started working here after finishing my mentorship with Jonathan. He and Raoul had known each other for years, so he'd vouched for me, even though I was just a kid. When I'd started hanging around Jonathan's shop, 10 blocks away, at 14, he told me to leave in no uncertain terms. When I kept coming back, he ignored me for a few months. When I made friends with one of his younger artists because we went to all the same shows and he introduced me, Jonathan rolled his eyes, but let me hang around. It had been nearly a year of inching closer and closer, fascinated by everything that went on in the shop, until one day he gave in. He grabbed me by the arm and pulled me to a messy station in the back. "Clean it up," he said. "Clean them all up, and then we'll talk." 6 months later, after a lot of cleaning and scut work, leaving my drawings one by one on Jonathan's station and never mentioning them, and dealing with a metric ton of shit from his other employees, I was Jonathan's apprentice. When I thanked him, so excited I could hardly believe it, he shook his head, half impressed and half irritated by my tenacity. It would remain his general attitude toward me for the tenure of my apprenticeship. What I didn't tell him was that after a year and a half of working my ass off to get in, I didn't plan on putting up with any shit from anyone ever again. I also didn't tell him that I was only 16, or that I'd been skipping so much school I'd never graduate. Nor did I intend to. When he found out later, he'd read me the obligatory riot act, because that's what Jonathan did. But then he'd clap me on the shoulder and winked, and I'd known he got it. After all, he'd left school at 15 to learn tattooing from a biker called Shannon, who had a reputation for the most delicate line work in the area, and for punching anyone who didn't like his tattoos. So when I told M&M that the shop was my home, I wasn't exaggerating. It was the only place I'd ever felt comfortable, accepted. The only place I'd ever woken up excited to go. It meant everything to me. I'd taken the apartment upstairs when Raoul had moved in with his wife 6 years ago, and I'd taken over the lease on the shop when they had their daughter 3 years ago. Raoul still owned a share of it, since I hadn't come close to having the cash outright, but I was slowly buying him out. I poured every penny the shop made back into it, and any money I made that didn't go to groceries or rent went to paying off Raoul. One day, the shop would be mine, officially. Now, with my best friend gone, that felt even more imperative. One day, no one would be able to take it away from me. No one would be able to tell me that tattooing was a waste of time, like my mother had. That I should get a normal job, like my father had. That I didn't have a head for money, like my sister had. Or that I'd never succeed in this business long term, like more assholes than I could count had told me. Meaning that women tattooers were only good for a few things. And none of them were being the boss. I held the promise of someday like a touchstone, focusing on it whenever I was stressed, whenever I was overwhelmed, whenever I needed to be reminded of what I was working toward. One day, the place I loved most, the place I felt most like myself, would be mine.
Christopher. Hey, Jay. I can't believe I'm gonna say this, but I might be sick of sandwiches. I know, blasphemy, right? But after months of messing around with proportions to make sure everything's in balance, I just want to eat something that isn't delivered between two slices of bread. For real, last night, I got Chinese takeout from this awful place on the corner, Golden Empress, which has been shut down by the health department twice, just to avoid eating dinner made up of the stuff I take home from the shop at the end of the day so it won't go to waste. But then, while I was eating really bad sweet and sour pork, I got this idea for a new sandwich. It'll be thinly sliced barbecue pork, honey mustard, cabbage slaw, and pickled red onion relish on rye. I'm going to try it over the weekend if I have some time. But see, sandwiches have colonized my brain. First year at Walnut Hill, we spent a month on eggs. Scrambled, boiled, fried, shirred, poached, deviled, over easy, omelets, quiches, souffles. At first, it was great. Eggs are the perfect food, but after a week, I was sick of them. After two, I felt like puking at the smell of egg yolk. By the end of the unit, I couldn't even see yellow without gagging. Anyway, as soon as Melt is in the black, I'll start buying real groceries again. Oh, yeah, I named the shop Melt. What do you think? I wanted something short, since everyone nicknames places anyway, but I didn't want to go totally abstract with it, you know, because it's a damn sandwich and coffee joint, and I definitely didn't want to call it Christopher's Sandwich Emporium or some crap, right? I'm sure you could have come up with the perfect name. You've always been better at the creative shit than me. Okay, well, I hope you're feeling better, man. Or, you know what I mean. I wish you'd let me come visit, but I get it. Love, C.
Chapter 2.
Go the fuck away, I mumbled at the beam of sunlight boring into my eye socket and buried my face deeper in my pillow.
The minute I let out a sigh of comfort, though, my alarm clock went off. I reached over the side of the bed to smother it, but I was too slow. The damn thing barked its robot dog creature bark and rolled under the bed. Convinced I could still snag it, I slithered to the side of the bed and reached as far as I could. My fingertips had just brushed its evil head when it robot barked again and rolled out the other side toward the kitchen. And I fell off the bed and landed on the floor in a tumble of blankets, hair, elbows, and swearing. I stared up at my ceiling, which I'd painted to look like a skeleton hand had broken through and was plunging into the apartment, unable to muster the energy to move. Fuck the morning for having sunlight. Fuck the floor for being hard. Fuck Daniel for finding that alarm clock at a street sale last summer and knowing I'd think it was funny. I rummaged around the blankets and found that my phone had fallen with me, so I dashed off a quick text to Daniel. Fuck you forever for this terrible alarm clock. May your every night be plagued with dreams of tart cherry jam and your descendants for 20 generations never find a moment of peace again. Love you. Jewish curses forever. XOXO. More immediately, fuck my own clumsiness. Last night, I'd shattered my coffee pot on the floor, which meant that the closest thing I had to caffeine within 50 feet was my coffee ice cream. Which... What were the caffeine levels in coffee ice cream? As promised, over the last week, I'd spent every morning before I opened the shop looking through the portfolios that tattooers had sent me, looking for someone who might be a good fit at small change. But no one was right, and for me to let some stranger into the sanctuary I'd created, they had to be right. There were some good artists, but two of them were mostly interested in styles that Marcus and I already did, and the three who were artistically complimentary weren't a good fit, personality-wise. The first, Carl, had been oblivious and inconsiderate. He'd interrupted often, told me he could help me with business strategies, and essentially acted like we'd be lucky to have him. When I told him it wasn't going to work out, he demanded to know why, and when I said it just wasn't a good vibe with the rest of the shop, he laughed and said he didn't really want to work at the chick shop anyway. Clearly a gem. The second artist we'd interviewed, Lawrence, had been a nightmare, which was doubly disappointing because he sounded great when I talked to him on the phone. He'd been excited about the work, had smart things to say about art, and seemed jazzed to meet everyone. But in person, he'd been pure, typical tattoo bravado from the moment he'd walked in. Marcus had met him at the door, and Lawrence had narrowed his eyes and given him the kind of knuckle-cracking handshake that certain men subjected Marcus to when they were uncomfortable. He'd hit on Morgan within 5 seconds of sitting down to talk to us, and when she'd shaken her head and said, "Stop," he'd raised his hands in a "who, me?" gesture and said, "What I do?" He'd been polite to me, but when I'd asked him why he was interested in working at Small Change, he didn't have an answer and didn't try to come up with one. He'd made the entire vibe feel gross, and we'd all agreed he was a no the second the door had shut behind him. The third artist had spent the whole interview alternately staring into space and checking her phone 15 times, Morgan counted. She'd seemed bored, rude, and entitled, and when I'd asked her how she got along with clients, she'd said, in a voice that suggested pride, "They don't usually like me, but they like their tattoos." Marcus and I had barely managed to contain our eye rolls at this. I understood better than most that in this macho business, sometimes it was beneficial to seem intimidating and hard-ass so people didn't dismiss you as weak or take advantage of you. But with clients, you had to be the opposite. Often they were nervous, or their tattoo was meaningful, or they were in a lot of pain. Making a client dislike you was a surefire way to ensure they never came back to a shop, even if the work was good. There were still two more artists I needed to call, but I had to spend this morning painting. I was way behind where I wanted to be, and the show at Malik's Gallery in January was getting too close for comfort. Hence why I had set my damn alarm for 8 a.m. on a Saturday when I hadn't finished in the shop until 1. Hence why I had dropped my coffee pot while blundering around last night. Hence why I currently had no caffeine and was actually gonna have to leave the house. "God, get it together, Holtzman," I muttered. I dragged myself up off the floor and pulled on the black jeans and bleach-spattered hoodie I'd dropped there last night. I didn't have time for the catching up that would be involved in running into people I knew, a real danger when you lived and worked in the same place for years. So, rather than go to Chapter House, my favorite coffee shop, I walked down 4th to Bainbridge, where a new coffee and sandwich shop had opened over the summer. It was close to the shop, and I made it my job to know the other local business owners. You never knew when you could help each other out. But, though I'd noted when it first opened, it had been so brand new and chaotic that I hadn't gone in. Then Daniel had left, and I'd thrown myself into things at the shop and gotten so busy I'd forgotten about it. Now, though, the promise of coffee and a bagel in a place where I didn't know every barista and customer sounded like heaven. I was already on to thinking about my painting when I walked into Melt. The sign outside was ugly, bad font, and too modern for the vibe of the place, which looked like a twist on the classic deli inside. Black and white checkerboard tile, black vinyl chairs and white cafe tables, and stools lining a chest-high counter that ran to the left of the cash register. The hulking espresso machine was shiny and high-tech, and the display case housed bagels and other pastries. There was a blackboard that listed the different sandwiches, but the writing was crabbed, and since it was too early for sandwiches anyway, I didn't bother trying to read it. I ordered a bagel and a large coffee with a quad shot from the geeky, bespectacled kid behind the counter, who seemed shockingly awake for this time of morning. He raised an eyebrow at my order and then grinned at me. He had a contagious smile, lazy and borderline silly. "I don't need a bag." I accepted my bagel and folded a dollar into his tip jar. I turned away to doctor my coffee, taking a big, excited bite of the everything bagel, the world's greatest combination of flavors, garlic, then onion, then salt, then cream cheese, exploding on my tongue. As the white cream unfurled into the dark coffee, my mind was back on the painting I was about to work on. I saw the way I'd razored the edge of my medium dry brush so I could stipple white into the black paint I'd laid down for the hair. As I took another bite of bagel and stirred my coffee at the same time, I almost knocked the cup over and I made a grab for it with both hands. In a cosmic joke repetition of this morning's alarm clock mishap, as I reached out to save my coffee, I dropped my bagel on the cafe floor. No! I cursed a blue streak at myself, at my coffee, and gravity, and crouched down trying to decide if the patient could be saved, but no. Its seeds were scattering the floor like the saddest glitter, and blobs of cream cheese had splatted around it. Mid-swears, bells tinkled, and I found myself squinting up at an indistinct figure in the doorway, carrying a cardboard box on his shoulder and backlit by the sun.
Everything okay here? The guy said.
I said nothing, too busy mentally calculating whether I was willing to drop more cash on another bagel, and immediately deciding it was necessary, not only to my sanity, but to my ability to even get up off the floor.
What do you do?
The guy asked, this time looking toward the kid.
Nothing,
he said. She, it's not his fault. I dragged myself up. I dropped my damn... I gestured unnecessarily at the dead bagel, grabbed a bunch of napkins, and started wiping at the cream cheese on the floor, giving the bagel a regretful pat before I dropped it in the trash. Then I carefully put a to-go lid on my coffee so it couldn't suffer the same fate. By this time, the guy had put down the box and gone behind the counter. Without the sun blinding me, I recognized him. I'd seen him around the neighborhood a few times and noticed him setting things up when Melt had first opened. He was tall, with the thick build of someone naturally powerful, rather than the kind of sculpted muscles of someone who worked out in a gym. About my age, I thought. Early to mid-30s. His thick red hair was cut close on the sides and long on top, combed back from a square hairline. He had a strong jaw and a smirky mouth, and his stubble was nearly blonde. It was his eyes that I couldn't look away from, though. They were almost the same color as his hair, a warm, goldish orange, and shot through with flecks of blue. My first impression was that his face was arresting. Interesting, the way sometimes in a gallery there's one painting that pulls you in and won't let you walk past. Each line eases into the next, each color shades into the one beside it in just the way your eye desires. Once you start to see the details, you can't look away. But the more I looked, the more interesting, converted to handsome as hell. He sliced a bagel in one clean stroke and spread it with cream cheese, looking at me with mild amusement.
Dramatic start to the day,
he commented, eyes sliding to the spot where I'd been crouched when he came in. Not even my first encounter with the floor this morning, unfortunately. I leaned an elbow on the counter, drawn toward him.
One of those, huh?
He spoke with the ease of a food service professional accustomed to such exchanges and the utter empathy of someone who actually meant it. He wrapped the bagel in white paper with a few quick folds and twists and put it in a bag. Then he added three more bagels and a plastic tub of cream cheese. When he held the bag out to me over the counter, it was accompanied by an easy smile that crinkled laugh lines at the corners of those extraordinary eyes and displayed charmingly sharp incisors that overhung his bottom lip a little, like a kid wearing dress-up fangs. He had dimples underneath his stubble, and I couldn't believe that I'd ever walked past this shop when it first opened with little more than an, oh, he's kind of cute, to spare for him. No, this guy was smoking hot.
Just in case the vagaries of your day find you needing another one, he said.
And then he winked at me. Not the friendly wink of a barista. A filthy, promise-laden wink that shifted his grin from charming to sexy as hell. I was kind of impressed he'd managed to pull it off, and I just looked at him for a minute. A smile, threatening. I fumbled in my pocket for my wallet, cradling the warm bag to me like a football, but he waved me off. Instead, he held out a hand across the counter, and I shook it. His was warm and a little rough, and the contact made me want to squeeze and not let go. We stared at each other for a moment before I mentally shook myself. But he still held on to my hand. "I'm Ginger," I said, gesturing toward myself with the bag I was clutching.
"That's usually my line."
He pointed sheepishly to his red hair with the hand that wasn't holding mine.
"I'm Christopher Lucen."
The door tinkled and a group of loud-talking South Philly ladies spilled in. Finally, he let go of my hand, reluctantly, as if he might have held it indefinitely without an interruption. "Hey, thanks," I said, holding up the bag in a salute and picking up my coffee. The ordinariness of the cup was disappointing after the feel of his hand against mine. His smile was far more engaging than it should be, and I was suddenly a little regretful that I had to get out of there. He nodded, his eyes crinkling warmly as he said,
"Good luck staying on your feet."
"His line works not clean enough," I insisted, pushing the iPad screen toward Marcus. "Come on, look at that." Marcus sighed, hope gone.
Yeah, you're right. That's the last one, huh?"
We'd just spoken to the final artist who had sent me a portfolio, and to our surprise and relief, he was a nice guy who seemed like he might actually fit in here. But there was just no way I would book in clients when there was a chance they'd walk out with shoddy line work. It was a basic skill, and this guy shouldn't have been able to make it at his previous shop for 2 years without it.
"We could always post an ad, I guess.
But it was the last thing I wanted to do. I'd be deluged with emails, and it was inevitable that the overly aggressive ones would stop by the shop. Looking at someone's crap portfolio while they were hovering at your shoulder was never fun. And the ones desperate enough to come around when I explicitly asked for an online portfolio were always crap. I considered Morgan and Marcus's suggestion of calling Paul. And as if Marcus could read my mind, he said, "We'll find someone.
I'll keep thinking, okay?"
Lindsay waved as her daughter Tara walked in. A single mom and ex-bartender, Lindsay was an ideal shop manager. Terrifyingly organized, bossy when necessary, cool under stress, and happy to leave the job behind when she left the shop. She got along great with Morgan, Marcus, and me, and we all considered Tara a bonus. We'd stopped referring to her as the shop cat when she'd said if she was the cat, then she was going to hiss at customers who displeased her, but I still thought of her that way. Tara was 13, and her school was about 6 blocks from the shop, so she came here for the last 2 hours of Lindsay's shift most days, because Lindsay didn't want her to be home alone. It had begun a few years ago when I'd hired Lindsay, and Tara was too young to do anything by herself after school, but though Tara sometimes complained, it was clear she liked coming here, because when her friends started doing things like going to the movies or whatever teenagers did these days, Tara nearly always came here. "Hey, love," Lindsay said as Tara dumped her stuff behind the counter. "How was school?" "Blah," said Tara, and though she was a small girl, she managed to collapse into an empty chair with all the drama of a tranked rhino collapsing on the savannah. "Oh, sure," said Lindsay, nodding and handing her a banana.
"Care to specify?"
Tara sighed and peeled the banana absently. "So, what's the deal with people who, like, get off on drinking each other's blood during sex?" she asked. Marcus choked on his coffee and started coughing. "Honey, inappropriate topic of conversation for a place of business.
There's no one here."
"Fine," Lindsay specified. "Inappropriate topic of conversation for a 13-year-old in public in general."
"Whatever, I'll just Google it," Tara said.
I could see the smile in her eye because she knew that Lindsay couldn't stand the idea of her daughter getting bad information. Morgan winked at me. It was no secret that Tara delighted us both, though for Lindsay's sake, we tried not to encourage her too much. Well, not in front of Lindsay, anyway. My last appointment of the night was a no-show, so I left earlier than I had in days. I was too exhausted to paint, but a little too wired to go to bed. I'd made headway on the painting yesterday morning, even if it had seemed like I'd spent half my time finishing off the bagels and cream cheese before the shop opened, and I'd feel obligated to share with M&M. Hey, everyone knew bagels were best fresh. It definitely had nothing to do with the fact that when I was eating them, My mind naturally wandered to Christopher, lingering on his broad shoulders, rough hands, and incredible eyes that crinkled at the corners. Instead of going upstairs, I wandered up South Street to Tattooed Mom, my favorite bar. The name was a coincidence. My friend Turner would be working, and I hadn't seen her in a while. In the before times, before Daniel left, or BDL, as Marcus lamented, Morgan, Marcus, Daniel, and I would go in for drinks after closing the shop on Saturday nights. But with me working on my paintings for the show, and Marcus trying to get home earlier lately, it had been some time since we'd done it. I made a mental note to try to get the gang together soon, for something non-shop related. "Ginger!" Turner yelled when I walked through the door, and she came around the bar to hug me. Turner's hugs were like body slams, and I grinned every time I found myself on the receiving end of one. Now that she was almost 6 months pregnant, it was more like squeezing a zeppelin. "How's all this going?" I asked, indicating her belly. Turner rolled her eyes dramatically and made me a drink. "I can say with 0% exaggeration that it's the effing pits. I'll spare you the rundown of which parts of my body are no longer under my control, which parts hurt, which parts are twice their normal size, and which parts I haven't seen in a while. I'll also spare you a disquisition on my moods, which at the moment are tending toward a sense of horror and dread. And lastly, I'll spare you the description of what I do when I wake up in the middle of the night, because apparently it's not enough that I grow life. I must also do it without sleep, which is contemplate the horrors of this already overpopulated world and wonder for the thousandth time what hallucinogenic plant matter or self-held pobulum I could have consumed to make me decide it was a good idea to bring another human being into it. Other than that, I'm excited. I'm going to be a mom. Yay." I squeezed her hand where it lay on the bar. "You're going to be a fucking epic mom," I told her. "I know this." Turner's smile lit her whole face. "Thanks, G." For all that Turner had a brutally honest approach to pregnancy, it was something she'd considered for years. And now, at 39, she'd gone for it and had been over the moon when it took. "Hey, how's my favorite tattooed mom?" Liam brought another flat of Yangling from the back and nudged Turner with his elbow. "That joke was bad the first 6,000 times you made it, Liam," Turner said, but she smiled at him. It was impossible to be mad at Liam. He was incredibly nice and incredibly stupid, and the combination really worked for him. "You guys, I totally just got the hottest guy's number," Liam said. "Yeah, do people seriously get numbers? Like, that's a real thing," I asked. Turner and Liam nodded. They worked in Hookup Central, so I guess I'd take their word for it. "Huh. I've never asked someone for their number in my life. Good thing, too, since you don't even call your actual friends," Turner said. I flipped her off with a smile while signaling that she should get me another drink. "Oh, it's easy," Liam said. "You just ask." "Yeah, I get the general principle, babe. It's just never occurred to me to use it. I mean, I barely want to talk to most people in person, so I can't imagine wanting to talk to them on the phone." "You don't call them," Liam said, like I'd suggested he paint. "You text." Turner and I exchanged fond, mildly exasperated looks as Liam started unloading the beer. "Hey, how's your other half?" Turner asked. "He's in fucking Michigan, T. Michigan! I mean, I ask you, like, what's in Michigan?" "Well, there's the automobile industry, Motown, the Great Lakes." Turner ticked them off on her fingers. "Ugh, whatever, that stuff." I leaned forward across the bar and stabbed a finger toward her. "Do you know the main claim to fame of northern Michigan?" "The Michigan tart cherry, I believe," Turner said mildly. "Number one, how the fuck do you know these things? And number two, why would anyone want a tart cherry?" Turner smiled as she slid beers across the bar to some guys who'd come in while I was tipsily yelling at her. "Number one, as a child, I enjoyed knowing facts about the states. And number two, dried tart cherries are absolutely delicious. They have a uniquely complex flavor, not unlike a fruity red wine." I gaped at her. "I'm a little in love with you right now. And I a little bit want to hit you." Turner nodded like this was a common sentiment. "State bird of Missouri," one of the guys called out to Turner from down the bar. Eastern Bluebird. The guy checked his phone. Whoa. Okay. Okay. State flower of Indiana. Peony. Dang. State motto of Montana. Oro y plata. Oh, my God. Okay. Oh, dude. This isn't a freaking sideshow. Find a trivia night. I called down the bar. The guy scowled like I'd stomped on his sandcastle and went back to his phone. Liam arched an eyebrow at me. Making friends, I see. She misses Daniel. Turner said, like it was an explanation for everything. Sigh. Daniel. Liam's voice was dreamy. Did you guys ever... No. No way. He's like my brother. Girl, if my brother looked like that... Just saying. I snorted and shook my head at him. Well, you can do whatever you want with your brother. Sorry to kill the dream, but Daniel totally met somebody. I'd never seen Daniel anything like this over a guy before. He was really gone on Rex. They'd met in February, when Daniel had gone to Michigan for his job interview and accidentally crashed his rental car into a tree when he swerved to miss a dog, which was incidentally so totally vintage Daniel that I couldn't even. Rex lived nearby and had found Daniel wandering around in the dark carrying the dog. It was a ridiculous meet-cute, and I'd teased him about it for months, with him shrugging it off every time. But when he'd moved to Michigan for the job and they met again, Daniel finally admitted how much he'd thought about Rex since then. Now they were dating, and from everything Daniel had said, which was admittedly less than I wanted to know, Rex sounded hot, kind, and way more into Daniel than he believed. Liam seemed shocked to hear this, but Turner just nodded her enigmatic nod. What? Well, I could always tell how much he needed you, she said. How much it meant to him to have someone he could look over at and know they got the joke, exchange a look when you both had the same thought about someone, and all that stuff. And it makes sense that when he was truly on his own, away from you and everyone who thought they knew him is one thing, he would find someone he could have that with romantically. My stomach felt hollow. Everything Turner was saying was probably true. And God knew I was happy for Daniel and hoped that this thing with Rex worked out, but hearing myself described that way, like a stand-in until Daniel could find a romantic partner, made me feel pathetic. I knew Daniel would never think of it that way. I'd just been especially raw since he'd left, and I'd realized how lonely I was without him. Raw, and maybe feeling just a little bit sorry for myself. No, sweetie, shit, I didn't mean it like that, Turner said as her words settled. No, it's okay, I know. Turner put another drink in front of me. How about you? Any love in the air? I was surprised when my mind went immediately to Christopher. After all, our entire encounter had only lasted 5 minutes, and he'd been handling cream cheese for 2 of those. But I couldn't get the picture of him winking at me out of my head. Or the way his hand had felt in mine. Warm and lightly calloused and a bit electric. Well, I went out on a date a couple weeks ago. Lindsay made me, I mumbled. Do tell, Liam said, and he and Turner leaned on the bar. Oh, man. Lindsay sold him to me so hard. Ginger, he's a teacher. He has a cute dog. He's smart and nice and handsome and blah, blah, blah. Well, to be fair, he was handsome. What'd he look like? Liam asked. He looked like... What's that store that always smells so strongly of disgusting cologne when you walk past it that you want to puke? Abercrombie and Fitch, said Liam. Yeah. He looked like a more boring version of one of those models, I guess. Like toothpaste, commercial teeth, and the kind of dude who'd own a windbreaker. So wholesome he looked like a manifestation of the American flag. Not my type, Bobs. Liam was shaking his head at me like I was causing him physical pain. So how was it? Turner prompted. Oh, it was fine, I sighed. Like the dictionary definition of fine, though. Meaning wholly without delight or horror. Which, just saying, I kind of like the horrible ones better. At least there's a good story to tell. This was just... He was pleasant?
Turner snorted.
Ah, she said in a prim English accent. Pleasant.
She mimed sipping a cup of tea, pinky in the air.
Yeah, exactly. He was nice. I was delightful, as always, duh. And we talked, and it was fine. And I thought, oh, this is a mildly pleasant conversation that I could have with almost any human on the planet.
Turner nodded along with me in sympathy. Liam just shook his head.
Yeah, if a guy is hot but boring, that is really not the strategy I'd recommend.
You're probably right, I said. And he probably was. I shrugged and was surprised to find myself thinking about Christopher again. About how he was definitely hot. And seemed like he was probably not boring in the least.
Christopher. Jay. I was right. The sweet and sour pork sandwich turned out amazing, and I'm adding it to the menu. Only on sourdough instead of rye. Duh.
Listen, man. I feel like a jerk sending all these emails about damn sandwiches, but since you don't write back, it's kind of been all I've wanted to say. But, okay, here. I have a crush on this girl. Yes, I realize that makes me sound 14, but it feels ridiculous to use the word woman in the same sentence as crush, like pairing caviar with cotton candy. And I can't really call it anything but a crush since I've only seen her a few times and spoken with her once. And maybe I said it like that, so you'd have warm, fuzzy feelings about how I said the exact same thing to you when I was 14. Not that you really had warm, fuzzy feelings that year. Anyway, if you don't write back, I guess you'll never get to hear about my crush, huh? Write me back, okay, bro? Just even to tell me you're reading these. Love, C.
Chapter 3. The next morning, I found myself in a position that was becoming disturbingly familiar. Lying on my back, on my own floor, staring at the ceiling and cursing my alarm clock. Only now it was worse because I was hungover and it felt like my head was going to explode. It was frankly shocking that I'd even remembered that I wanted to get up early to paint again, much less that I'd been able to set the fairly fiddly alarm mechanism on the robot dog in my intoxicated state last night. I groaned in self-pity, but it just hurt my head more, so I slowly rolled myself up and gingerly made my way to the kitchen to make coffee, the only thing that ever helped when I was hungover. I got terrible migraines, had ever since high school, and in comparison with those, this wasn't the worst, but I definitely couldn't paint like this. Only in the kitchen, I was faced with the realization that I hadn't bought a new coffee pot yesterday. Holtzman, I muttered. Desperate times call for desperate measures. I pulled the carton of coffee ice cream out of the freezer. It was the one thing that I always had on hand, even when there was nothing else to eat in the whole apartment. It was the perfect food, and right now it was going to save my life. No way could I eat fast enough to get the caffeine without adding brain freeze to my hangover headache, so I scooped it into a pot and melted it on the stove. I mean, coffee ice cream was just coffee and cream and sugar, right? And I put cream and sugar in my coffee, so what was the difference? I couldn't believe I was about to put the best ice cream on the planet in the position to fail at being coffee. I mean, when something was great at being ice cream, what more could you possibly ask of it? But here we were. I poured the melted ice cream into a glass, swore an oath that even if it didn't taste good as a coffee substitute, I wouldn't stop loving it in its frozen state, and gulped it like medicine. Huh. Well, definitely lost something by changing states, but surely it was better than nothing. I took another sip. Maybe, but not better enough. I was going to have to leave the house. I sniffed the clothes I'd worn to paint the other day, and they seemed okay. A wide-necked black and white striped t-shirt and oversized black overalls. I stepped into my no-lace black docks, because who has time for laces in the morning, grabbed my canvas jacket off the back of the couch and slunk outside, shaking my head at Daniel's voice in my head that said, maybe, just maybe, I'd purposely forgotten to buy a new coffee pot the day before because it meant I had an excuse to see Christopher again. Shut up, Daniel, you psych 101 know-it-all, I muttered, and sent him a text that said, After much study, scientists conclude that melted coffee ice cream is not a viable substitute for coffee. Frowny face. Within seconds of being outside, I felt better. It was a cool, sunny October day. My favorite kind of day. I could smell damp and some warmed leaves, cinnamon and sugar from the roasted nuts in the bodega on the corner, smoke from someone burning garbage, and the clean bite of a cold snap coming, but held off for another day. My phone dinged with Daniel's reply. Tell me you didn't. I was desperate, I texted back. Then I was in front of Mel, and I caught an unexpected glimpse of myself in the gleaming windows. It was always disconcerting when I was reminded that what people saw when they looked at me wasn't the same as the picture I had in my head. In my baggy overalls and oversized coat, I looked short and a bit rumpled, and the side of my hair that wasn't shaved was an utter mess, dark curls flattened in the back and springing madly around my face and shoulder in the front. My sunglasses covered what I'm sure was clear evidence of my hangover, and I looked mad. I always look mad, people told me. My mouth naturally turned down at the corners, so even my neutral repelled the world. As a kid, grown-ups had been solicitous. What's wrong, sweetie? Are you okay? My seemingly evasive answers of nothing or I'm fine were taken as stoicism at best and a bad attitude at worst, though I had been telling the truth. I hadn't understood why they always asked. Why just going about my business made people think that something was wrong with me? For a few years, when I was in my early teens, I'd worked hard to counteract it, taking care to plaster my face into a neutral expression that felt like a smile. It hurt my face and triggered my migraines, and though it was a massive effort to maintain, it looked to the world like my face was merely a blank. I ran a hand through my hair, but there was really nothing for it. It was thick as hell and curly, and trying to get it to do anything except be thick as hell and curl where it wanted was futile. Then I realized that I was basically staring in a window, breakfast at Tiffany's style, only without the coffee and croissants, which were the best part, and grinned, imagining Moon River playing over my entrance instead of the tinkle of bells. I reminded myself that Christopher might not even work today. It was the weekend. Maybe he had a standing brunch date with friends, or slept in, or went jogging along the Schuylkill, or was a super religious churchgoer, or something. Ginger, hey, said a warm voice from behind the counter. I slid my sunglasses down, the world's most unholly go lightly. Yep, definitely him. You're back. His smile made his dimples pop, and his bright hair gleamed underneath a backward baseball cap. I felt a warm, excited feeling in my stomach, and my heart started beating faster. He looked so genuinely happy to see me. And you're not in church, I said. Nope. It's been a while for me. Besides, it's Saturday. Oh, right, I said and pointed to myself. Jewish. Christopher smiled, clearly waiting for me to explain why I'd brought it up in the first place. When I didn't, he said, How'd it go, then? Though there were other customers waiting in a flurry of activity behind the counter, it still felt like he was focused entirely on me. Go? Yesterday. Did you manage to stay off the floor? I did, I said. Not quite so lucky this morning, though. I ran my hand through my hair again, and my fingers got tangled in it. I'm glad to see you again so soon. I broke my coffee maker, I grumbled. And I can't without caffeine. Can't what? Anything. He smiled at me and raised an eyebrow. I have a show soon.